Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I am your host, Erica Monahan, here on the Russian and Eurasian History Channel. And today, it is my pleasure to talk with Andrei Ivanov about his book, A Spiritual Revolution, The Impact of Reformation and Enlightenment in Orthodox Russia. This book was published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2020, and it won two different prestigious book prizes. It won the 2021 Mark Rieff Book Prize and the book prize awarded by the Early Slavic Studies Association. So I am happy to congratulate Andrei for that. Andrei, our guest, is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. And I also want to acknowledge that since the attack on Kiev in February 2022, over half a year ago now, he has many families in Ukraine that he has helped to leave Ukraine, and he also has family in Ukraine that he has been taking trips and working to support and help in a variety of ways. And I want to kind of extend our best wishes to Andrei and his family. And I also want to just acknowledge and say thanks for, amidst all of that, doing your job and doing history. So, and thank you for taking the time to be here with us today, Andrei.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Super. Well, traditionally on the New Books Network, we like to start out asking everyone the question of, how did you get interested in history? Why did you become a historian? And maybe, so just could you tell us a little bit about your path into history?
So on the larger kind of a mega galactic level, I'm a historian because I was born a human being. So history is one of the things that distinguishes us from the animals. The animals don't have a historical memory, and we do. So I think it's very natural, very human to love history. People love history depending, you know, any kind of aspects of history, you know, is what interests people, whether it is medical history or it is genealogy or it is the record of your favorite team in the sports league, or it is the war, or it is the history of financial transactions, or, you know, really any kind of, any way you look at a human economy or human life or culture, there is history to it. So that's kind of like on a larger level. On a specific level, why did I go into history professionally? It's been a process for me. In my undergraduate, I was a political science major with pre-law concentration, and I really liked I took some law classes, and I really liked forensic investigation and this kind of stuff. And what kind of brought me into a study of professional history is really the interest in investigation, the interest in recreating the patterns of events, the reasons, the motivations. And so I went through sort of kind of pre-law track to history track and did a second history major with great professors that had inspired me and led me into this journey. So, and this was in Fresno in California, as well as in Davis, California. So I've had really wonderful undergraduate professors who sort of led me into this path as well. And so that's how I ended up being becoming a historian that is going to a professional degree program at Yale. This is where I became a professional trained historian, where I got my master's degree and then my PhD at Yale.
Super, thanks. Yes, indeed, it seems that behind every great historian, there's some great teachers. Okay, and now to A Spiritual Revolution. Why did you write this book?
Well, there's a story to that as well. I, when I was in graduate school, I took several classes in Eastern Christianity. And of course, I'm from Ukraine, so this is a very familiar subject to me, but I wanted to learn more. I took also patristic languages, Koine Greek and Latin, and I took patristic courses. And I also took a course on early Russian history, including Orthodoxy. And I, having a divinity school background at Yale, reading a lot of Orthodox literature from 18th century and 17th century in Yale, gave me sort of this background. So I was reading Saint Tikhon of Zadonsk. And when I was reading his works, I realized that this looks a lot like Johann Arndt. And then I started digging more into this. And, you know, since I was familiar with Johann Arndt from divinity school courses on Protestant theology, I realized that this is just very heavily influenced by Johann Arndt. And I wanted to learn more. And I started reading George Florovsky and the ways of Russian theology. And I realized that there's a story that needs to be uncovered there, the story of Protestant, of enlightenment, of awakening, Western awakening, theological influence in the Russian Orthodox Church, and not just theological, but larger influence. So I started thinking about this project, and I wrote a dissertation, but the dissertation was more of a kind of like a prosopography of Russian bishops, many of whom were influenced by the Reformation and Enlightenment. And then, you know, about roughly 5 or 6 years after my dissertation, I started rewriting and kind of doing rethinking about this project. And what really turned me to rethinking and rewriting were new sources. I went to Regatta, to archives in Moscow, which in addition to Gia gave me, in St. Petersburg, gave me additional resources. I went to Rome, to Vatican archives. I went to the archives in Collegio Greco in Rome. I went to the Eastern Oriental Institute, the Oriental Pontifical Institute in Rome. I found some amazing sources in Germany as well, in Halle. And these sources really kind of guided me to write this book and just sort of abandon what I did, some of the things I did in the dissertation, and just write a book. Some of it related to dissertation, some of it just completely new. And so I wanted to tell the story that hasn't been told before, the story of this Reformation and Enlightenment influence in the Orthodox Church. And the best way to do that was to process the new sources that I found and to put this book systematically as a history of the long 18th century in the Orthodox Church.
Thank you. I want to come back to these big ideas of Reformation and Enlightenment in Russia. But first, let me start kind of a little bit at the beginning and ask you to walk us through the structure of a book a bit, because there's so much rich detail in here and fascinating stories that I think it is worth the audience hearing about. And so I want to start chapter one. Chapter one, you call Russian Orthodoxy on the Eve of the Reforms, the Ukrainian context. Why do you begin your story with Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine is really the meeting point of East and West in Eastern Europe at the beginning of 18th century, late 17th century. And Ukraine is where Russian Orthodox Church would get not only the most educated hierarchs in the 18th century, or early part of 18th century, but also would get Western ideas. Ukraine is important for two reasons. One is that it had educational institutions like Kiev Mohyla Academy that was patterned along the Jesuit collegia of Eastern and Central Europe, and had the same curriculum. So with that curriculum, you have Ukrainians who are trained in Western sciences of the day. So you have direct connection to the West in Ukraine, and including educational connection. But a second reason is Ukraine has a very sort of rich tradition of Protestant influence. If you read Hrushevsky's book, The History of Religious Thought in Ukraine, Історія релігійної думки в Україні, there is quite a bit of analysis of 16th and 17th century in Ukraine and the influence of Protestantism in not just the Calvinist Protestantism that was very widespread in the Lithuanian part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, but also Socinianism and so on. And then the relationship between the Orthodox nobles and the Protestant nobles in the Commonwealth and so on. So Ukraine had a background in Protestant influence that went back to the 16th century already and had that context. So I wanted to start with Ukrainian context, because without it, we can't really understand what's going on in Russia in early 18th century.
Thank you. Now, staying with this first part of the book, and you do, I love the way you treat the curricula that churchmen in training are going through. And chapter two focuses on one of these churchmen, and you call it, chapter two focuses on Feofan Prokopovich, whom you call the Russian Luther. We'll get to that. But as reading this book, I was downright surprised about learning about Orthodox churchmen studying in Rome. It seemed so unexpectedly cosmopolitan to me. And so could you tell us a little bit more about this? I mean, what are Orthodox churchmen, or are they really Orthodox or all the time? What are they doing in Rome? You have this one subheading in the book, temporary apostasy or expedient dissimulation. What's that all about?
So in the 17th century, Ukrainians who wanted to study in Rome and who were Orthodox had to temporarily convert to Catholicism. The Roman Curia knew of this phenomenon, and that is why many of the Ukrainians who studied in Rome didn't have to take juramento, didn't have to take the oath of loyalty to the papacy, to the office of papacy, to the Holy See. And so they allowed these Orthodox to kind of have a half-hearted conversion. Some of them converted, of course, sincerely, some of them did not, but this was a subject of dissimulation. This was the idea of dissimulation or temporary apostasy that was very widespread in Ukraine. In order to gain knowledge, in order to go to university or school in Rome or Olomouc or Prague or any other Catholic collegia in Europe, Ukrainians had to convert to Catholicism, Uniate Catholicism in particular, and that's what they did. So that practice of temporary apostasy was well tolerated and existed during this time in Eastern Europe. Feofan Prokopovich, whom I'm writing about, indeed goes to Rome, and just like Luther, he is absolutely horrified by what he sees in Rome. He has this kind of conversion experience in Rome. He turns against it. He turns against papacy, and then he goes to Germany and imbibes the Protestant ideas that kind of transform him. Prokopovich is called Russian Luther. I use that term in my book because this is a term I borrowed from one of the contemporaries that described Prokopovich, Anton Albrecht Firoth, who was the head of Pietists in Estonia, was a friend of Prokopovich, and when he wrote about Prokopovich in his correspondence and his diaries and so on, he compared him to Luther, and so this comparison to Luther comes from contemporaries of Prokopovich. They look at Prokopovich and they say, well, he's just like Luther. He goes to Rome. He has this conversion experience. He even has, you know, Bayer, one of the contemporary biographers of Prokopovich, even describes an experience with a lightning. You know, Luther had a lightning experience. Prokopovich has a lightning experience. So there's that comparison in the sources. So that's where I draw that term. I draw it from how contemporaries described Prokopovich, a Luther in Russia.
Okay, thank you. Now, I have to point out as well that I was on a bus tour in Rome where we just drove by and they pointed out the Pontifical Greek College, and they sort of said, this was the Catholic Orthodox, college. And that's kind of all they said with no elaboration. And it was only, you know, thanks to having read your book that I had a deeper understanding of some of what went on there, right down to the, you know, documents that you reproduce mm-hmm. in your book. So it was a great read. Okay, so Feofan Prokopovich, like Luther, is appalled by what he sees in Rome and makes his way back to Russia via Germany, where he's picked up some Protestant sympathies. Now, what awaits Prokopovich when he returns to Russia? And maybe I would even tag on to this. Are there reasons beyond, and you gave excellent reasons, his sympathies, that contemporaries are calling him this. Are there more reasons in ways in which you see the comparison with Luther holding up or not for how Prokopovich's life unfolds in Russia?
Well, if there are any more sort of parallels to Luther, well, you could always come up with some. I mean, one is that Luther has his Frederick the Pious. There's a secular authority that is helping Luther essentially introduce the Reformation in Germany. And without that secular, without the Philip of Hesse, without the Fredericks the Pious, without what's going on in Scandinavia, without sort of the princely or royal element, there would be no Reformation. And in Russia, it's the same way. I mean, just the initiative of one bishop, Prokopovich, or two bishops, or three bishops who had proclivities or who liked ideas of Protestant theology, that alone would not propel the changes that had happened in the Russian Orthodox Church in the 18th century. There was also the element of political power, and in particular, Peter, and then Anna, Empress Anna, and then Empress Elizabeth, and later Empress Catherine, Catherine I and Catherine II, who played quite a bit of a role in making this happen, pushing these reforms forward. So yes, there is that, you know, other element. You know, we can compare Prokopovich to Luther, and you know, his radical nature of his reforms that were assessed as radical at the time don't appear to us as that radical now, but at the time it was considered quite a bit a movement from away from what was viewed as sort of traditional orthodoxy at the time. Yes.
Okay. Now, speaking of state support is kind of a good segue into my next question, perhaps, that as the story progresses in time, in after Peter dies in the post-Petrine period, the story, as I read it, comes to involve an awful lot of politics. And so, of course, at some level, I'm asking an unfair question, because as historians, we generally find that the best explanations are more complicated and nuanced explanations. It's not an either or. But mm-hmm. with that notwithstanding, I do want to ask, how do you see what's going on in these factions that are emerging? To what extent is it theological? To what extent is it cultural? Is it straight up politics of people jockeying for position in the hierarchy?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am emphasizing the theological aspect. These are theological factions that are relying on political support to advance their agenda, and the agenda is theological. Just like there has been a turn in Soviet history from turn to ideology, there has also been a turn to theology in our study of Russian Orthodox Church during this century. And I'm not, you know, there's been a number of scholars who have been looking at this and saying, well, there is a turn to theology, and theology is important. This is not just politics, well, you know, doing what Empress Anna wants. No, this is theology doing what the bishops define theologically, doctrinally is sound teaching, and not heresy, versus others say, no, what you believe is heresy and our doctrine and our teaching is sound and true. So I'm arguing it is theological. The parties, the factions are theological. There's also kind of a little bit of a cultural element with sort of more Northern European versus Eastern South European, kind of Catholic versus Protestant divide, cultural divide. But theology is really the primary focus of my study of these political factions and political fighting. even in the case of foreign relations, like, for example, the diplomatic relations with Spain, which I argue are suspended for also for theological reasons. And there's a theological fight that goes on in 1730. that involves confrontation between Russia and Spain.
Okay, so then here we are seeing the Reformation in Russia among church elites unfolding. The church elites that, you know, in my introduction to Russia were these stodgy, unchanging traditionalists. And the story you're telling over the course of the 18th century, the long 18th century, isn't that at all. So tell us a little bit more about what happens in this nearly century post-Peter to the you know, early decades, the end of Alexander the First's reign. Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways to understand this long 18th century, and this is what I'm doing in my book, is to look at the influence of three very important movements that happen in the West, but we don't know much about their manifestations or incarnations in the East. And I'm saying there's a lot of what is going on in Eastern Orthodox Church. So one is the influence of Reformation, Protestantism, Pietism included. The second one is Enlightenment. Enlightenment comes into Russian Orthodox Church, and it really changes the hierarchy. It changes the way Russian Orthodox Church understands education, parish work, the way Russian Orthodox Church understands emancipation and relationship with the peasantry. So the Enlightenment is really important. And then the third sort of end of that, some people would argue it's sort of the part of the late Enlightenment or reaction to Enlightenment, is the Awakening. This is where we get the Bible Society movement, and this is where we get also various sort of new pietistic influences in the early part, the early decades of post-Napoleonic Russia. And so these three important events are known very well in the West. We know about Protestant Reformation, we know about Enlightenment, and we know about the Awakening, right? You know, people have heard about the Great Awakening movements and Swedenborgians and the Church of Latter-day Saints. They all emerged out of the Awakening. And was there Awakening in Russia? Of course there was. And we need to tell that story and how that also happens in Enlightenment. Is there a story in Orthodox Church about Enlightenment? Of course there is. So the way to understand my book is to look at these three movements in the West and ask a question, did this happen? Did any of this movement have an impact in Russia? And so I'm looking, you know, we think, a lot of us think that, or historians have been thinking about Reformation, Enlightenment as a kind of a dual or two-sided story, right? Two books, right? The Catholic Enlightenment, the Protestant Enlightenment, or the Catholic Reformation, the Protestant. I'm arguing this is a trilogy. This is a trilogy. with an Eastern Orthodox component that has been neglected, and now I'm trying to bring it to the fore and start a greater conversation about this, that there's a trilogy of Protestant, Catholic, and then there's Orthodox Reform, Enlightenment, and so on.
Okay, thank you. Well, here, this this prompts me to ask a little bit. You talk about a trilogy. Did you think about including the third component of the story, the Awakening, in the subtitle? Or because, I mean, Reformation and Enlightenment, those are heavy hitters as far as historical episodes go. What you've just said now talks about a trilogy. Why did the Awakening get left out of the subtitle?
Subtitles are, once they get too long and too heavy, they create problems with the way the book is presented in general. Also, to write, you know, I only have really a chapter and a half on the Awakening. It's kind of like the ending of the Enlightenment, because the Awakening is seen as the end of the Enlightenment. And some have argued that the Awakening is part of the Enlightenment. There's a whole story about Philadelphia and Awakening and Philadelphia Enlightenment that was sort of part of that. Or the Neo-Pietistic Enlightenment in Württemberg. With Hahn and later in Germany with Krudener and so on. So some would say that this is part of the Enlightenment. So I didn't want to go into a title that has Reformation, Enlightenment, Awakening in it, if Awakening is presented more as a continuation of Russia's Enlightenment. Also, the enemies of the Awakening in Russia, the enemies of the Bible Society, viewed Awakening in Russia as a continuation of Enlightenment and as a continuation of Protestant Reformation. And this is how the discourse or the discussion of Bible Society debates was presented in, you know, under Nicholas I in particular, and late Alexander, when they were banning the Bible Society and doing a reverse sort of a reform by 1836 with reversing many of the changes that happened in 18th century. So I think it is good to talk about the impact of reform, Protestant reform and Enlightenment, and leave out Awakening, because Awakening is presented here as a part of a larger movement, but also we need a book on the Awakening. We really need a book on the Awakening in Russia. And I know Stephen Batalden has written a book that pretty much comes out as a magnum opus describing the Bible Society. Bible Society is one of the elements of that. So we need another sort of set of great books like this to give us a full spectrum of understanding of the Awakening in Russia in the early part of the 19th century. And so I didn't want to sort of have a title that's hanging out there and that really deserves a separate book.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for that. Yeah. I want to ask you about kind of where your book ends up. So you sort of said you see the Reformation is one episode, Enlightenment is another episode, Awakening is another episode. Some people see it as a subset of Enlightenment or whatnot. And there's, you know, various ways that people can conceptualize and understand these changes that come. And so I just want to ask you to talk a little bit more about, in your understanding, to what extent is Enlightenment in Russia synonymous or near synonymous with a Protestant ethos? I mean, in Russia in the 18th century, if it, I'm kind of thinking about the chronology of that this story in Russia doesn't start in the 16th century, but rather we're seeing it in the 17th century. And so, yeah, I just like to ask you to talk a little bit more about how distinct or together unified you see these episodes.
Yes, I see the influence of Protestant Reformation as a gateway to the Enlightenment in the Orthodox Church, and I'm talking about a religious Enlightenment in particular, not the secular Enlightenment. And in this way, the Orthodox Church is very much in conversation and in, you know, has a lot of ties to Germany and Pietism and Halle and so on, and Göttingen, and also to Oxford and Leiden also, but very, very few ties to Catholic theology, including Catholic Enlightenment theology of the 18th century. So on the one hand, Protestant ethos does sort of open up the Russian Orthodox Church to Enlightenment. On the other hand, the Enlightenment that the Russian Orthodox Church is exposed to is mostly German. And German Enlightenment in the 18th century is heavily associated with Pietism, and by that with Protestant theology, the Protestant Enlightenment theology. Folks like Lawrence Mosheim, who becomes a great hit in the Russian Orthodox Church, but also is, you know, the chancellor of Göttingen University, where Russian Orthodox students go and study, and also, you know, Wolfian theology or Wolfian philosophy becomes a hit in Russian Orthodox seminaries. Again, this is coming from Germany. So, you know, there is a kind of an ethnic element that's associated with Northern Germany and Protestant Germany that influences how Enlightenment gets transferred, Enlightenment ideas get transferred into the Orthodox Church. See, I'm not talking about how Enlightenment ideas get transferred into the minds of Radishev and Novikov. Of course, they're reading a lot of French Enlightenment, which a lot of it is, you could classify as secular. But in the Orthodox Church, we do have, you know, the Enlightenment ideas are transferred from Germany. And one key element that I think is present in German Enlightenment, religious Enlightenment, as well as in the Russian religious Enlightenment, is this idea that revelation comes not only our knowledge of theology, our knowledge of doctrine, comes not only from revealed sources, such as the scripture, but it also comes from reason. Reason is a source of revelation. And this is something that the Russian Orthodox Church sort of get directly from the Germans and from Protestant Enlightenment in Germany.
Thank you. Yes, and thank you for making this distinction between kind of the rational Enlightenment coming more from France, perhaps, and a spiritual Enlightenment. On this kind of, here's a beginner question for the spiritual Enlightenment. What is Pietism?
So Pietism is a 17th, 18th century German theological movement. That becomes the harbinger of Enlightenment, and Germans classify it as Frühaufklärung or early Enlightenment. Pietism is seen as a kind of a liberation force that liberated German Lutheran theology from sort of the shackles of old Lutheran orthodoxy. And some view Pietism as this movement that focuses on reason, on rationality. It focuses also on various elements of charity. For example, their orphanages are world famous, and so on. On translation of literature in various languages of the world. This is where Moravian movement comes in, influenced by Pietism, the idea that we should translate all this literature into different languages, with interest in patristics. An interest in Oriental languages, Armenian language, Eastern Slavic language, Church Slavonic languages, Aramaic, and so on. So Pietism is this movement that tries to take German Lutheranism out of the sort of old confines of Orthodoxy and Orthodox debates. So the Pietists don't care, for example, about the distinction between Calvinist understanding of the Eucharist and the Lutheran understanding, or, you know, understanding of predestination. They move beyond that and they try to look at how do we understand the world theologically if God has given us a reason and not just revelation to do that. And how do we develop new epistemologies to understand the world around us and so on. So this is something that Pietism does. And Pietism in its early Enlightenment phase is very much sort of into that, but it also is into piety. So that is why it's called Pietism, is because it focuses on individual spiritual progress. And Pietism in Scandinavia in particular, and Pietism also in Germany in many ways, becomes almost like a neo-ascetic movement. That's why when I was reading Tikhon of Zadonsk, I was surprised to see that Russian Orthodox monks found pietistic devotional literature to be very suitable for the practice of monastic orthodoxy, because a lot of pietists in Germany were very strict about sort of how ascetic a regular Lutheran should be. And so when the Eastern Orthodox are reading ascetic sides of Pietism, they find it very appealing. There's also a late Pietism, also known as Neo-Pietism, in very late 18th century, early 19th century, sometimes called Württemberg Pietism. It's a different sort of strain of Pietism. It goes more into revelation and predicting the end of the world and so on, and calculating when the end of the world happens. This late strain of Pietism, I don't really deal with it very much except when I go into awakening, but that some historians would say is not very sort of relatable to the rational Pietism of the early Enlightenment. So that's kind of a way to explain Pietism, but it's a major movement in Germany and Europe, Central Europe in the 18th century.
Thank you very much. It is a real pleasure to get to tap into your knowledge on these theological movements. Let me Okay, I know we don't have too much more time, but I want to come back to where the book ends. When the book ends, we have this, so a sort of reformation, enlightenment, awakening has taken place among the elite in the Orthodox Church in Russia, correct? And so I want to, I'm sort of wondering, how does the turn of the 18th to 19th century church in Russia compare to churches to the West? And you could take your pick for what to answer. And I also want to ask, how, to what extent has this Reformation Enlightenment sunken down into the masses, or does it stay among the elite in the church, or how do you see it?
Mm-hmm. So the influence, the thorough influence of Enlightenment, and before that Protestant Reformation, of course, you know, it stays in the elites. The elites propagate these ideas to the masses in various ways, and that's how these ideas sort of become ingrained in the masses. One is through education, that is seminary education, which becomes very Protestant influenced and then Enlightenment influenced. That is, for example, priests learning French and reading French literature under, including Voltaire, under Evgeny Bolkhovitinov's, for example, supervision when he was teaching in the seminaries. And we're talking about seminaries like Voronezh, for example. We're talking about seminaries like Tambov and so on, and Novgorod, and not just Moscow and St. Petersburg and Kiev. So we have education that, that influences sort of lower echelons of the Orthodox Church. We also have the ideas that influence the relationship with peasantry because of the emancipation of 1760s. We're not talking about the 1860s emancipation. We're talking about the emancipation with church reforms, land reforms, and so on. And that is influenced, that's where you see some of the influence. But there's also some curious impacts of Reformation influence with the translation of New Testaments into vernacular languages, like the Crimean Tatar language in 1820s, and or in Udmurt or Chuvash language, and so on, and spread of that literature in various sort of Russian nationalities. And finally, you know, one of the interesting side influences that I found was the emergence of sectarian or Duchobor movements, for example, in Tambov, and Molokan movements in the 18th century. One of the documents or one of the files that I was looking at, the reports to the Holy Synod, were talking about the people in Tambov Gubernia, the peasants, reading the catechism of Prokopovich, you know, which is also known as Первое учение отроком or Букварь. And that catechism is based off Martin Luther's catechism. And so, well, what happens after the peasants in Russia start reading the catechism of Feofan Prokopovich, which of course is official catechism of the Russian Orthodox Church in the 18th century? Well, some of them start getting the ideas that they shouldn't have icons in their homes. And they start taking down icons from their homes. And then, you know, one thing leads to another. And then we have the Duchobors, and then we have Molokanya, and we have other sectarian movements that emerge. And how do they start? Well, they just start reading Prokopovich, which was the official doctrine of the Russian Orthodox Church in the 18th century. They just got these ideas from the official catechism that icons were somehow idolatrous. Of course, that's not where Prokopovich was going in his catechism, but you could read it that way if you read it in a certain way. So this is, you know, there's all kinds of sort of, and of course you have the emergence of opposition after in 19th century, you have the counter reforms, you have this whole idea of kind of liberal segment in the Orthodox Church that that turns against Nicholas I and then reemerges against during the Great Reforms and so on. And so there's a larger story that goes up until 1917. And, you know, we have also the story of the Red Priests, right? You probably heard about these priests in during the Russian Revolution that become very radically liberal for the Orthodox Church. But I'm arguing that a lot of these sort of a lot of this is happening already in the 18th century. And then once the movement is essentially canned by Nicholas I, by the counter-reform, it still stays in one form or another, maybe in the underground form of some sort in the seminaries, and continues to influence the seminarians and the Orthodox church clergy or especially educated clergy in the rest of the 19th century. So I'm saying there is an after story that still continues, but we need to go back to the origins, and the origins are these influences, Western influences in the 18th century.
Thank you. It is such fascinating work, and that just gives us so much to think about. Your final comments there talk about counter-reformation, talk about the famous conservatism of the Orthodox Church in the late 19th century in a period of reaction, et cetera, and just thinking about the ebbs and flows of the thinking of church elites. Anyone thinking about that should definitely read A Spiritual Revolution, The Impact of Reformation and Enlightenment in Orthodox Russia. The book is by University of Wisconsin Press. And so Andre, before I let you go, I would like to thank you so much for this fascinating discussion. And at New Books Network, we always like to ask people, what are you working on now?
Well, I have a biography of Ivan Prokopovich that I'm working on right now. And there's also a monograph that I'm working on that is related to my dissertation, actually, that studies the military sermons, the wartime homilies in Imperial Russia. Essentially, I'm looking at how the Orthodox Church interpreted wars in Russia from the Seven Years' War until World War I. I'm looking at these various wars and how the Russian Orthodox Church preached about these wars to the masses. So those are two projects I'm working on right now.
Wow, and isn't that letter a very timely one? Well, Andre, thank you so much. It's really, really been a pleasure. I encourage everyone to read the book yourself. It's really a fascinating and worthwhile read. And with that, I will say thank you very much and have a terrific day.